Hello, I'm Joan Novak, and I teach at Denison University. And this session is a two-hour session talking about sexual ethics. And I'm going to be presenting what James Nelson advocates in the book Embodiment. It's available in the bookstore, I think. It's a yellow cover paperback. And so most of what I'm getting, the major outline, comes from Dr. James Nelson. It's published by Augsburg Press. Now, in doing sexual ethics, talking about sexuality, and two, trying to sort of show the kinds of concerns that an ethicist brings to a task. So you try to do two things. One is make explicit how ethicists work, people doing moral theology, how they plan on doing it, and secondly, trying to perhaps shed some light on our sexuality and how we ought to respond to it. I will begin by talking by discussing why Nelson thinks we need to do something different in sexual ethics. His book is in many ways a very creative breakthrough. It builds on other people's work. So we're going to talk a little bit about how sexual ethics had been done, why Nelson thinks it should not have been done that way, and what he proposes in its place. The session is long, 2 hours, so kind of after we, you know, we'll be breaking for discussion along the way rather than waiting to the end. Now Nelson looks at the past on how ethics have been done in sexuality, and he finds it wanting for a variety of reasons. And this would be a traditional way it had been done. This is the way that was done by classical natural law. And what classical natural law did is it looked like at a variety of sexual acts. I listed 8 of them here. And judged them as either thumbs up or thumbs down, moral or immoral. And it had certain criteria to be used in terms of determining whether they were moral or immoral. The first one is that criteria they used is the purpose of sexuality, or the purpose of sexual organs. And the argument goes something like this. Our eyes, obviously, have a function to see, right? So we have to look at each part of the body and see what its natural God-ordained function is. Now, Nelson's going to disagree with this, but this is what he's arguing against. Okay, our speech, the function is to communicate, right? That's why God gave us speech. And so we want to ask why God gave us speech, therefore to communicate or to lie, to communicate falsely would violate the natural order God intended when God gave us speech. So the traditional approach says, what is the purpose of genital organs? Clearly it's to make babies. That's why God gave us, that's the first purpose, is to make babies. Therefore, any genital act, using the genitals sexually in a way that could not create babies, was considered immoral and wrong. So the first 4 are immoral because they can't lead to babies. And so they can look at it in a nice manual, have masturbation is wrong. Using birth control pills or any form of artificial contraception is wrong. Homosexuality is wrong. Oral genital sex is wrong. It can't lead to procreation. Nice, simple. However, with human beings, the traditional approach said, is there are certain things that would be wrong for human beings that would not be wrong for animals? Because our sexuality, our sex, is not only concerned with making babies, but to build love relationships among people, and love relationships so that sex should take place in a family context, because we need a family to raise our children. So, it's also immoral if it doesn't build love relationships and build a family. So, premarital sex is always wrong. It's not done in a family relationship. Adultery is always wrong. Rape is always wrong. I don't think this would assume that a married person could rape another married person. However, what would be right then is married people having sexual relationships without any artificial birth control method. You see how the argument works? The purpose of sexual activity is procreation and promoting love and family. It's always wrong if it violates one of those two standards. Now, from an ethical viewpoint, you know, this method has some advantages. It's nice and non-ambiguous, right? Very clear. Anybody can look at that and know, what's right and what's wrong. You know, it gives a lot of guidance. It's easy to understand. People can understand it, so you don't have to be a college professor to figure it out. There's a rationale provided. You know, it's not just pure arbitrariness. Acts are wrong if they don't contribute, don't have the possibility of having babies. Acts are wrong if they don't take place in the family context. And finally, and this is a very important thing, there's only one standard covering all activities. For instance, many of my students would like to look at that first list and say, use of birth control is okay, but homosexuality is wrong because it can't lead to babies. Now, what they're doing is they don't have any reason for taking birth control out or taking masturbation out. So they then get into a thing where they have a double standard, right? They're saying homosexuality is wrong because it doesn't lead to babies, but birth control is okay, but that doesn't lead to babies either, but it's a different standard. That makes ethicists very, very uncomfortable. But this is the way it's been done. But is it adequate? You know, it's got some nice advantages, but is it adequate? Nelson says no. And I'll list three reasons. The first reason is he says it's too narrow. It concentrates on sex acts, not on sexuality. In fact, it reduces sexuality to sex acts. And there's much more to our sexuality than this. According to Nelson, sexuality is what is important. And sexuality is our way of being in the world as men and women. Sexuality includes our emotions. It includes how we understand ourselves, how we relate to one another. If I gave you all a list, you know, and didn't tell you what we were going to do and say, write down the words that describe who you are. You'd probably get things like Christian, American, and very high on the list, man or woman, don't you think? If you're just free associating, who are you? It's an essential part of our identity. And our sexuality, who we are as men and women living in the world, affects all of our relationships. Take, for instance, our relationships with the baby. What's the first question people are inclined to ask if they see a baby wrapped in a yellow blanket? What are you going to ask? Is it a boy or a girl? And somehow that affects how we relate to that baby. And we'd be very frustrated, as in there was a novel, I think it was called No Name. And there was a kid that was raised and nobody knew what sex it was. You know, and when it went to school, it had its own special restroom, so nobody could find out if it was a boy or a girl. Even with babies, you know, you want to know, is it a boy or a girl? My relationships with my father are different than my relationships with my mother. Sexuality, the fact that I'm a woman and how I understand my womanliness, relates to all my relationships, right? Even to my married colleagues, be they men or women, right? To my friends. So the first thing he says is this kind of approach to sexual morality is just too narrow. It limits things too much to sex acts. When we're dealing with sexuality, we're dealing with our whole way we relate to other people. Because sexuality is involved in all relationships. How I understand myself as a woman, how he understands himself as a man, how we feel about ourselves, this influences all our relationships. Okay, the second reason he rejects this approach is it's too simplistic and too rigid. Nelson argues that sexuality is a language for communicating. We communicate through gestures. We don't just communicate verbally, but by body language, right? Ways we carry our bodies. Let us take an example. I think we'll all come up with the same one. Say a man, by body language, comes up to a woman and very nicely and very politely expresses interest in her sexually. That can happen, right, without saying anything? Say she doesn't want that advance, but he hasn't insulted her, so she wants to say no by body language without saying, buzz off, jerk. How would she do it? Turn her back? That would be pretty, I don't think I'd be that nasty. Stand with your arms crossed. How about just sort of ignoring? You know, just ignoring it. You could stand with your arms crossed if you're really getting kind of, you want to get, you know, keep away. That really means, you know, or just sort of ignore it, right? Women are awfully good at ignoring things, aren't we? You know? That's kind of a nice way of saying no, isn't it? Our whole body language influences how we communicate with one another. So we have all sorts of different languages. A wink means something in our culture, right? Touch on the arm means something. We all know this language, and we can communicate quite well with one another without even saying things. Now, this implies, though, that this approach implies that all cultures have the same sexual language. But we know that's not true, right? We put a lot of, kissing is very important to us as a form of sexual language, right? And notice how ritualized kissing is. We know the appropriate kiss for a great aunt, we know appropriate kiss for a nephew, and we know appropriate kiss for someone of the opposite sex whom we love, right? And they're very different, aren't they? Now, in some societies, kissing isn't really that important, is it? And you go up and kiss them, and they wouldn't know what in the heck you're talking about. I don't know if it's really true, but supposedly rubbing noses is big on Eskimos. I know one thing that does happen in terms of different cultures have different things, and culturally assigned roles in sexuality. So he's suggesting we can't generalize just from one culture to another, as this system does on the nature of the act. For example, in certain New Guinea tribes, the culturally assigned role is that the woman is always the sexual aggressor. And she's got a real problem. Because in these New Guinea tribes, men are uninterested in sex. So she has to entice them. You know, they try to get these people that don't care about sex interested. And her method of doing it is to pinch, coyly pinch his arm. It gets him interested. You know, it's the American equivalent to, would you like to come up and see my etchings? And so clearly, you know, our language is culturally conditioned, right? So that's the second problem. This isn't taking part of the fact that how we interact with one another is culturally conditioned. The third problem is, since sex is a language, the words or the gestures may have different meanings in different situations, right? You're a jerk. And depending on how I say that and to whom I say it, that can be a compliment, a tease, or that can be a real kind of nasty statement, right? Different contexts, different meanings. It's the same way with sex. Now, this allows for some of it. For instance, sexual intercourse. That can have, which is loving, which is natural, can lead to procreation. That has an awful lot of different meanings. It can be meaning something very compassionate, can't it? A compassionate sharing, a most intimate sharing. It can also mean somebody dominating and dehumanizing another. Who can give you an example where it would be dominating and dehumanizing? Rape is the obvious example. Now, this takes it into account. You know, rape would be one that wouldn't be allowed. But take within sexual activity within marriage. Within marriage, sex can be used to manipulate the sex partner, can't it? Either men or women can use sex to manipulate their spouse, to try to get them to do what they want, to withdraw sex to sort of punish the spouse, and get to be very nasty, right? Well, I have some friends who are living outside of marriage, They've lived together now for 5 years, premarital sex, and I think they're one of the most loving, honest, open couples I've ever known. You know, they've been together 5 years now. I really don't understand why they don't get married, because they're going to have a common law marriage in a couple of years anyway. But, you know, for them. Now, which is, you know, this is very clear, right? My friend my friends are living in sin, and these people that are manipulating one another in marriage are living in purity. That isn't quite the same. And notice this really doesn't make enough distinctions on premarital sex. There's a big difference between my friend and the woman he's living with, who have a very open, caring, loving relationship, and somebody that goes and has premarital sex with a prostitute. There's a big difference, isn't there? This, you know, context make all the difference in the world. And so this doesn't seem to do justice to context. So Nelson would claim that sexual expressions transcend, go far beyond biological acts, and that we can't just classify acts as good or bad, as the old system would do, but rather we have to look at each act in terms of the meaning, the context, the intention, what is being communicated. Now, I'd like to say, I don't know how many of you had the same experience, but when I was a kid, I didn't grow up with this system, but I grew up with one that was pretty ritualized too. You know, what you could do on dates were clearly defined in informal rules. You wouldn't kiss a guy on the first date in high school. Then you'd be a bad girl. What's a date you could kiss him on? Is it the same? Third date? Does that make sense to any of you? Any of you remember that? Yeah, then you'd be okay, right? In fact, the third date, even if you didn't like him, you owed him a kiss, right? Everything was kind of highly ritualized, you know? Everything was sort of, it was sort of the same structure. Everything, you knew everything that was going to take place. You know, when I was at college, my date would come, and, you know, it was just, everything was so predictable. You know, I'd walk down the stairs and carry my coat. When I was out on a date, I could never put my coat on myself. I don't know how I managed to get to classes with coats the rest of the year. I'd hand him my coat, he'd put my coat on, we'd get to the door, my arms would go straight, you know, and get immobile. I'd deftly step aside so he could open the door. We'd get to the car, I went around to my side, my arms would go numb again. I would step aside, he'd help me in, we'd get in the car, he'd close the door for me. You know, it was nice and easy. He'd pay for everything. Then we'd get back to the parking lot, he'd make the pass, I'd say no. I mean, it was all, you know, it was all spelled out. All of us, each of us knew what was going to happen. It was a nice, rigid system. Now, in a way, so what was, and if you violated that system, and you were a woman, you were considered a bad girl, right? You were considered bad. And so there was all the system, and everything was all figured out. Now, this led to, of course, a double standard of morality. So the sexuality I grew up with, the sexual ethics, was inferior to this, because there was, here there's no double standard, right? No double standard for, not one standard for men or another standard for women. But of course, when I grew up, there was a double standard. How about when you were growing up? Double standard of morality? Yeah, I think one of the horrible stories I saw would my story my brother told. It was one of his fraternity brothers had taken out a high school girl who was considered, quote, a bad girl. And she got drunk, so he undressed her as she passed out, had sex with her, and complained to my brother that she wasn't very good in bed. That kind of domination, double standard. My brother said he almost slugged the guy. Despite pacifist leanings, I wished he had. But don't tell anybody. It led to all sorts of stupid double standards. I was at a Lutheran Student Association conference once on sexuality as a student. And there was a man there, he was a college student. And he said he dated two women at the same time. One he loved and respected and therefore would never touch. So, you know, his love was separated from sexuality, and one that he didn't care about that he used for sexual outlet. that kind of double standard, very crazy kinds of things. At least this has one standard of morality. Okay, now we're going to next look at what Nelson advocates a little bit. But before we do that, does anybody have any comments or complaints about this part of it? What people are criticizing in the way we've done sexual ethics in the past? Why Nelson rejects it? And how it might really apply to the way we've done it, or at least the way most of us were conditioned when we grew up in terms of sexual activities. Do we have any comments before we move on? Complaints, hassles? Okay, let's move on to see what he proposes. Now, in this system, they start with what is the purpose of sexual activity and came up with first procreation, then promoting love and family. Nelson takes the same approach. First of all, he says sexual ethics must be concerned with sexuality, our way of being in the world as male and female, an integral part of our identity. So he's not interested, his book is not going to deal just with sex acts. You know, he's not going to have a nice catalog of this is okay and this is not. Okay, so then he moves to what is the purpose of sexuality? And procreation comes secondary for him. The purpose of sexuality, he says, primarily in human beings, is sexuality is God's ingenious way of calling us into communion with others. Sexuality is God's ingenious way of calling us into communion with others. Sexuality includes our need to reach out and touch and embrace people emotionally, intellectually, and physically. So sexuality is the part in us that needs affection. Not always sexual affection, you know, overtly sexual acts. When I move, one of the things I really need is to have friends. I'm single. I can do it without a sex partner, but I need friends. I need someone to talk to, someone that I can share my thoughts with. That's very important to me. So that's what the purpose of sexuality is. To call us into communion and caring relationships. To call us into friendships. To help, to enable us to it's fun to be touched, right? By someone that you like and likes you. It's fun to be touched, a woman to touch another woman. It feels good, right? A man to touch another man. A child. That's what's fun about children. You ever notice most of us have been sort of raised to be a little bit inhibited, but you get these little kids, you know, and they come sitting on your lap, and, you know, they're so free to express affection. Do you ever notice that? You know, they haven't learned to be ashamed of their affection yet. That's nice, isn't it? And that's our sexuality. So it's not limited to sex relationships. We're missing the boat entirely. Sexuality is calling into friendships, our need for companion. Sexuality is involved in parent-child relationships, platonic friendship relationships, relationships with everyone. The idea of sex, then, is to bring us into communion. And he defines that as love, nice Christian term. Now let's talk about love. Love, then, is a union which binds together unique individuals. Love is a reunion, a union which binds together two subjects. And their individuality is preserved. Let me give an example. I used it last week, so if any of you were here, I apologize. But I think it clarifies it the best. Now, we really wouldn't call it love if I married a man and totally expected him to conform to everything I wanted him to be. That meant he moved to Granville, because that's where I teach. He gave up his conservative Goldwater politics and becomes a liberal like I am. He gives up his atheism and becomes a Christian. He stops fishing because I hate fishing and begins to take up horseback riding, even though he never liked it before. He stops watching football games and ends up time watching documentaries on TV. Now, you think I have a lover? I don't think that's love. I got myself a nice trained puppy doggy, didn't I? Right? That's not what love is. Love is the coming together of two individuals, so their individuality is preserved. Neither would be love if I married this guy, and all of a sudden I gave up my job, moved to Texas, I gave up my liberal politics, became a conservative, I stopped being a Christian and became an atheist, I gave up horseback riding and started fishing, and fishing, and fishing, and I no longer watch anything on television except 20 hours of football a week. That's not love. He's dominating me. Love is a mutuality, a coming together of two people where there's a creative tension and each one's concerns and cares and feelings are respected. It's a relationship not between a puppy dog and a person, but between two people. I find it sad that whenever I do this at Denison, to give an example of what love means, I have to use love between two people of the same sex, friendship. Because in friendship, people see this mutuality, the coming together, the sharing, where one time you do what one friend likes, another time you do what the other friend likes, and you make allowances for each person's individuality and all that kind of stuff. You know, that's what friendship is. And many of my students can't understand that in terms of male-female. You know, it's always one dominating the other, one using the other. Now, similarly, that kind of love would apply to all relationships, right? Sometimes college students have difficulty when their parents won't let go. Have you ever known anybody whose parent tried to dominate them after they reached the age of reason? Trying to mold them, not letting them have their freedom? Again, you have a sense that this is not love as possession. Love is not possession. Love respects the individuality. Okay, the third thing he wants to say then is the same is the benefit of this system. And this is it applied to everybody. You know, the same moral principles apply to all. And so Nelson will insist in embodiment, the same norms must apply to all people. They must apply, there is no double standard of morality. It applies to men, the same laws as or guidelines. He doesn't come up with laws. The same guidelines to men as to women, to somebody that's 21 as to someone that's 81. The same principles would apply to a homosexual as to a heterosexual, to a married person as to a single person. We want nice, consistent laws that would or rules or guidelines that would apply to everyone. So that's what he's doing. And the main thing is to understand what Nelson is, you have to see what the purpose of sexuality is. Sexuality is something very, very good because it's God's ingenious way of calling us into relationships with others, making other people attractive to us, making us want to touch, communicate, love, share. And that happens in all of our relationships. It happens in my relationship to my niece, my relationship to my nephew, my relationship to my mother, my relationship to my father, my relationship to my grandparents. Okay? Is there any comments here now? You see what he's about? Anybody have anything they'd like to disagree with or raise questions at this stage of the game? Okay, he really likes sexuality, doesn't he, huh? You're certainly not going to find him negating sexuality. Okay, so what does he do? At this point, he makes a very Christian move and starts talking about sin and salvation and what God empowers us to get to salvation by God's grace. The God empowering us is called grace. So what does he mean by sin? He means being estranged, being alienated, being torn apart within ourselves, and torn apart from one another. Grace, God's love, empowers us to become whole, to reach communion with others, to be reunited. And the distinction he makes is between dualism and duality. Let me try to explain that distinction. Dualism then refers to estrangement, alienation, being torn apart. Duality, the wholeness, communion, reuniting. In a dualism, there's a conflict between two elements. I like to think of that as a bad marriage. You ever met some people just right on the verge of divorce? Theirs was a dualism, right? They were conflicting with one another, they were living together, but always in kind of hostility. You know, couldn't quite get along, and there was this real tension. That's dualism. Duality, on the other hand, is a really nice marriage. You know, where you have two people living in creative tension. You know, they don't sacrifice their individuality. And, you know, it's not roses all the time, right? Even in the best marriage, you got your tensions. But there's a harmony that works out, and a duality. So dualism is when we live in conflict. Duality relates to love, living together. Now he thinks there are two kinds of dualisms that affect our society. Now one student, when we were reading it, said, he's really condemning our society. You know, he's saying everything we do is rotten. Yeah, ethicists tend to do that. They don't write books about things they think are going perfectly. You know, I mean, they write things about things they think aren't going well. And so Nelson claims that we learn spiritualistic dualism and sexist dualism, and dualism then is this really bad tension, from our culture. And as we learn it from our culture, it's bad. We learn it not intentionally. We pick it up as we're socialized. You know, all of us, when we're little kids, we have to be taught how to act by our parents and our culture. And we learn lots of things, right? How to eat with a knife and fork, how to walk, you know, to wear clothes, to comb our hair, to brush our teeth. And he says we also learn spiritualistic and sexist dualism. So the fact that we have it shouldn't surprise us. If his analysis is accurate, we have it. The question is not to feel guilty, but what would we do about it if we discover he's right? So let's see what spiritualistic dualism is. Let's start with that one. Spiritualistic dualism is thinking that our mind, our spirit or our mind, is superior to our bodies. Mind dominating bodies, very common in the United States. We become alienated from our bodies. We see our true sense of identity as something different from what our bodies are. Let me give an example. This is one I fall into more often than I like. I buy his analysis, but I always fall into this one. The notion that the body is a machine and my mind controls it to get what it needs. Just before I came to Holden for about 6 weeks, things got messed up and I had a bunch of work I had to do. Conferences I had to attend, some speeches I had to give, and I was literally going crazy. So what did I do? I'd given up smoking for 5 months prior to that, and I said, well, I have to kick in what I call my compulsive obsessive stage. You know, we just work, 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 work. Well, the way to do that for me is to drink coffee and smoke cigarettes, so I started smoking again. Because I wanted my body to conform to my mind, right? I ate irregularly, because I live alone, so I would eat whenever I wanted to. You know, when I got so hungry, I couldn't stand it. I went without sleep at least 2 nights. Often went without sleep some other nights. You notice what I'm doing? I was just using my body to try to get my work done. Business executives often claim, you know, people claim business executives do it, or other people do this. Some people even take drugs to do this. The drugs I was limiting myself to were coffee and nicotine. But, you know, people would use drugs to get their bodies to conform to everything they want to do. That is a prime example, he said, of spiritualistic dualism. I've taken up horseback riding this last year, and I assure you, I'd never treat a horse the way I treated my body. Would you? You know, horses, you walk around after they're hot. You know, you rub them down so they'll feel good. You know, you try not to overexert them. This is one of those things where you overexert your body. You don't really care about what the body needs. All you try to do is keep the body in minimal working order so you can get all your work done. Do people know what I mean? You've known that? Well then, I've I hope I get through the session. You might tell I have kind of a bad cold, and I'm just hoping I don't break off into coughing spells. If so, we'll have a break. When I came to Holden then, it was sort of a joke. I've been arguing that it's very unfair. Because I came to Holden, and for a week, I was very nice to my body. You know, I ate regularly, because now we have, you know, the bell rings. I got, you know, nice amount of sleep, you know, because they're, I mean, after 10 o'clock, what are you going to do around here? You know, I mean, you know, it gets dark, nice amount of sleep. I was drastically cut down on cigarettes, didn't quite eliminate it like I was going to. Eating healthy food, you know, none of these quick stuff down, these fast foods kinds of stuff in a hurry, you know, taking time to talk. And I was hiking at least 2 hours a day, you know, up to 4 hours a day. And then I say, and it's unfair because after a week, my body gave me the worst cold I've had in 5 years after I treated it so nicely. Well, you notice, even the way I'm talking, when I was telling this joke, it dawned on me, I'm falling into spiritualistic dualism. Because I'm implying that I am different than it, my body. That's spiritualistic dualism. Implying that I am somehow different from this. You know, this is what I am. I'm an embodied self. That's where he gets the word embodiment. I'm an embodied self. Now, this is this kind of thing of making the mind a machine, a body the machine to be dominated by the mind. It's common in, you know, you think in high-pressure jobs. You think of business executives and heart attacks and ulcers and all these things that come from it. But it happens to women, too. I don't know about any of the women here, but I know my mother's Christmases, she had to do this. You know, we'd go to one grandparent's, and Dad would stay and play cards, and the women couldn't leave, you know, with his brothers. But they would have to sit in the kitchen and drink coffee because somehow she couldn't go home. That would be rude. Why, my dad played cards at 3 o'clock in the morning. Then she'd have to get home and wrap all of our presents. And then one of us would wake up at 5 in the morning to open them when she had 5 minutes of sleep. Unfortunately, that was me instead of my brother. He could sleep through Christmas. You know, and it's the same thing. She was allowing the pressures of her life to turn her body into a machine. That's one example of spiritualistic dualism. Another example or manifestation of it is when we feel embarrassed about our bodies. Embarrassed about our bodies. About normal bodily functions, we're embarrassed about them. You know, as if they're bad or unclean or something. And I think this is more common among women than among men, and I don't think it's inherent in women, but it's the way we've been socialized. Take, for example, do you remember when Happy Rockefeller and Betty Ford had mastectomies, and it was all over the paper and all the little, you know, the Life magazines and everything? I remember one of my colleagues at Merrimack College, typical spiritualistic dualism, thought that was horrible. That was just terrible. The people were, you could actually see breasts in magazines. You know, it was embarrassing. Notice how alienated he was. I'm not, you know, that was probably very good for a lot of women. You know, many women went and found out, you know, found lumps in their own breasts because they were encouraged to examine themselves. Why should we feel embarrassed about breasts? But yet the spiritualistic dualism causes us to feel embarrassed about our bodies. My liberated college students who think they're so liberated nowadays, you can just feel the tension in the classroom rise the first time somebody mentions menstruation. It's a taboo subject. I think it's a fantastic subject, very interesting, like why I see, how people create babies, you know, all these things are very interesting to me. But the spiritualistic dualism is somehow, we can't talk about this. It's a taboo subject. It has to be hidden. Now this, of course, has had drastic kind of implications for medical care, particularly when some women have been embarrassed about their bodies and didn't get pelvic examinations. Ended up dying from cervical cancer. You know, it was an easy to detect cancer. or some students at Denison are having sexuality, but they're too embarrassed to go to the Planned Parenthood, which comes to campus, to get birth control. They're just too embarrassed about their own bodies. Or one of the things I saw, this really, I just felt so sad. It was, again, Denison students, and I'll call them men and women, but boy, it's hard considering how they were acting. It was evidently a slave thing, you know, where you buy some guys for, you know, their services for a while. And the women students were giggling behind the magazine rack because they sent the men students, who were evidently their slaves, to buy Tampax and stuff like this. And they all thought it was funny. You know, they're like little kids. That's really alienation from one's body, right? I think we feel the same way when we're embarrassed about feeling sexual drives. I can remember this as a little kid. No, I wasn't a little kid. I was in college. You got to get these. I don't want to lie to you because, you know, communication is what's the... When I was in college, I remember I was just thinking, gee, wouldn't it be nice if we didn't have sexual drives? Because then we could be rational all the time. And even then, I was becoming aware that, you know, sometimes, you know, you felt these sexual drives and you didn't want to be perfectly controlled all the time. Notice this is a devaluing of the body. Our body's good. It's a good creation for God. Our sexuality, says Nelson, you know, is God's ingenious plan for calling us into communion with other people. Spiritualistic dualism prevents that. Okay, we've had two examples of it then. One is when we use the body as a machine to be controlled or dominated. The other is when we're embarrassed about our body or about normal bodily functions. The third, and I think this would be more of a problem with men than with women. The first, the embarrassment about the body is more, I think, a problem with women. This one, I think, is more of a problem with men. Again, not because of how they are, but the way our culture has socialized them. The sense that we have to control emotions. All of us do to some degree, but I think it's particularly strong with men. I can remember my little brother, my older brother. It's a Freudian slip. He's older than I am. But I could cry, but not my brother. Be tough. Boys don't cry. Come on. You know, be hard. Be tough. Don't cry. Be a man. A sense of really not being able to express emotions. Having to control all the time. Again, this kind of thing can lead to physical illness. My brother, since then, has my sister-in-law has been sort of teaching him how to be tender and express emotion. And this has been a great liberating thing for him, and particularly helpful was when they had babies. Because they nursed, wasn't able to nurse the babies, and after the first baby she continued to work. And my brother then became one of the primary parenting figures, and he loves babies. And it was so much fun to see him, you know, tenderly taking care of the baby, and I think he enjoys babies more than his wife. You know, fondling them and feeding them and changing the diapers, you know, and all those kinds of things. And I think he really had a kind of a great liberation that my father didn't have, because I don't think my father cared for us when we were babies. This is often seen in terms of this inability to express emotions on the way men express emotions for other men in our cultures, not in all cultures. Some of my American friends have been had African roommates, and they always describe how interesting it is, you know, when they would walk in college and meet their African roommate, the first thing he would do is hug them, you know, and they weren't used to that. Holland is kind of one of the few places where you see men hugging men, right? You know, how's a normal way men have to express emotion? Well, Stella Denison, there seems to be two primary ways. One is if a guy really likes a guy, instead of hugging him, he will often... Now, it's quite a little different at Holden. You know, you see a lot of men hugging, but they can able to express their emotion. But this guy will often come up and hit him on the back as hard as he can and call him the nastiest name he can think of. And that says, I really love you. You know, can't say I love you, because that, you know, men can't express emotion to men. Or if a group wants to honor a man, how do they go about doing it? Roasting? You know, they can't express affection, so they have to sort of insult the person. You know, so somebody retires and he has a roast. The only thing I've ever been able to figure out is it's kind of interesting, that there's one place where men can hug other men and can cry. There, complete freedom to cry, complete freedom to love men or hug men. You think of what that might be? What? Oh, funerals, okay. We allow men to have more emotions in funerals. But even then, didn't the society admire John F. Kennedy and, not John, but Bobby Kennedy and Teddy Kennedy, you know, for being so dignified and not breaking down at the death of their brothers? You know, we give greater freedom there. Yeah, sports activities, right. And sometimes if you lose in a sports activity, you're supposed to cry, right? Or you didn't show that you really were giving your 120%. Or how about, I mean, come on. Where else but on a basketball or football field will you see a man go up there and a guy's going out and pat him on the fanny? Huh? You know, that's about the only time we allow men to really sort of express their affection. This would be seen by Nelson as a sign of spiritualistic dualism. Okay, how does it deal with sex? Particularly with sexuality. Well, one thing spiritualistic dualism sometimes calls asceticism. Denying sexuality. Denying it. Saying that sexuality is bad. The early church fathers did this. And somehow you would be better off trying not to feel sexual drives. Asceticism. Most of us don't buy into that one anymore. But a Dominican friend of mine said that the way his monastic order handled this was he was told if he ever had a sexual feeling, he was supposed to think about football. Notice that saying, that's inferior, right? There's no place for it. Another way, says Nelson, is by casual promiscuous sex. Depersonalized sex. Now notice in asceticism, the mind is considered so superior to the body that you don't even want to feel sexual drives, right? Notice in casual promiscuous sex, just the opposite happens. The mind is so detached from the body, you let the body do what it wants to do. But there's no feeling. There's no emotion. There's no caring. You can see this because there's kind of an interchangeability of partners. It really doesn't matter who the partner is, right? In fact, the partner is almost reduced to an object to give sexual pleasure. It sounds coarse, but I think in some of these really promiscuous sex, it's almost like the partner is a vibrator. You know, it doesn't matter who it is. Notice again, there's a separation between the body and the mind. No emotion. The body is seen, let it do what it wants to do. And then in America, he says, we have this big obsession with performance principle in sexuality, where a sex act is successful if you perform correctly, if you get orgasm. And that's, you know, sort of let the body do its thing. It's not successful if you're able to communicate and express love. But this whole, you know, boy, is our society kind of, you know, you need all those sex manuals, right? You know, they're all around on everything you wanted to know about sex and was afraid to ask. And, you know, sensuous man, sensuous woman. And what are they? All techniques for achieving orgasm. And the kind of the thing is, if you're good, you're always going to have sexual partners. Notice I think people ought to be able to achieve a sexual orgasm. That's really nice. But we get almost an obsession with it today. An obsession with it. The primary purpose, says Nelson, is not achieving orgasm or controlling one's body, but being drawn into loving communion. Being able to care about one another. So somehow physical intimacy would be proportionate to sexual, emotional intimacy. Finally, we see this alienation in our sexual activity in terms of what Nelson calls the sexual disenfranchised. People that are sexually disenfranchised. We see in these people that we don't consider sex an integral part of people activity because there are some people we say just shouldn't have sex ever. Mentally retarded people. How many of you know or have had any experience with a child with Down syndrome? Are they tend to be loving? Do they want to feel? Do they want to touch? Do they want to hold? Now, all those things are going to be called sexuality, right? And one of the things that is, if you ever visit hospitals, the nicest ward to be in is the mentally retarded ward, isn't it? You know, I mean, you're almost over, you know, covered over with affection, right? Everybody's hugging you and loving you. Yet, we want to sort of pretend, the way we set up these institutions, you know, that these people shouldn't have any sexuality, even though they clearly do. We're saying it's not an integral part of them. So when one person went and visited a home for mentally retarded, he was a sex expert, and he said, now how is he going to try to, you know, help deal with mentally retarded people in this area? The one question he got from all the nurses was, how can we stop him from masturbating? Okay, now he says we ought to really question this. Now there might be some reasons, you know, why these people may not be able to be always responsible parents. Might want birth control, or how about marriages within these places? I don't know, but you know, it's just something's kind of funny, says Nelson. We ought to sort of say sex is not an integral part of everybody's personality. It's not important for mentally retarded. Can you think of any other groups of people that might be sexually disenfranchised other than mentally retarded? Where we sort of think they shouldn't have sex, that somehow they shouldn't be an integral part of themselves? Yes?
Blind.
What?
Blind.
Yeah, the handicapped people. Yeah, quadriplegics. Yeah, often quadriplegics, men can have erections. They may not be able, you know, to have orgasm. But we often treat, you know, badly to, handicapped people as if, you know, they have no sexual drives. And people that have had paraplegic husbands or wives have sometimes found, you know, other ways of having sexual relief, you know, and sexual communication, just as oral genital sex or something. But the handicapped people, you know, sort of, if you're in a wheelchair, you're not a sexual being. Any other groups of people? Yeah, the older citizens, the ages, in some nursing homes, they won't even let husband and wives live together. You know, they may have been married for 50 years, but now, doggone it, get them in different rooms. As if, again, sexual drive remains in many elderly people. They see themselves as sexual beings, the sexually disenfranchised. Yeah, prisoners are another good example of it, right? They're starting out. The South, interestingly enough, had more apt to have visits between a man and his wife, you know, in prisons earlier. But prisons, a lot of our prison punishment is really sexual punishment, isn't it? Huh? Saying that people can't go to prison, you know, they go to prison and they can't have sexual partners. Mental institutions, sure. No privacy, no ability to have any of these sexual relationships. Notice this is all saying that somehow sexuality is not a part of who we are. That's right. For the longest time until Freud, it was assumed children had no sexuality, and then it became apparent that they did. Yes? Well, there's some, one has to look and see, you know, with whether the Down syndrome could be inherited or not inherited. You know, sometimes, you know, there are some that could or some that couldn't. What would be the, you know, caring for the kids might provide a problem, right? Perhaps one could have forced sterilizations or some mentally retarded people who have been allowed to marry in institutions or in halfway houses have used birth control. You know, so yes, there are lots of problems. I don't think we have to be particularly concerned that, you know, that's going to have a rapid decay of the gene pool.
Is there a law, right, that mentally retarded people can have children if they want to?
No.
So there's a genetic variation
Well, we don't, generally in our society, we don't say by law people cannot have children, even if they're at risk at having deformed children or children with handicapped. You know, we don't have, mentally retarded have been more subject to forced sterilizations than other people because they're institutionalized. And, generally in our society as of now, we don't have any laws. You know, this date, you know, if I'm a carrier, what? Yeah, yes.
It depends on whether they're ward of the court or whether they're considered competent, which has a lot of ethical issues too on how do you decide somebody's competency to make their online decisions. And it differs from state to state and from court to court. But it is really difficult. It's very, very difficult. I've dealt with some couples where one or both members were, you know, severely handicapped in one way or another, and sometimes you really question whether they can care for that child. But it's hard, you know, whether you can therefore deprive them of the right. They were cared for by the state, so in some ways they were also okay. By the time the child is, will be cared for by the state if we can't. So it's a huge ethical problem.
Yeah, some of the forced sterilizations have, as you're getting challenged more and more in courts, and some of them have been done without consent and everything, and done as common practices. But it still varies from state to state, right? And often you can get away with it because the retarded person isn't in the way to press lawsuit. What was that one example they found that wasn't even retarded of those doctors in that town in the South, the only ones that would deliver babies, and they decided which women had too many or on welfare, and so they wouldn't deliver the last baby unless they would undergo sterilization. They got away with that for a long time before a woman finally managed to get it public and get a lawsuit on it. Okay, anything else in terms of, can we move on to sexist dualism or anything in spiritualistic dualism? Is it a problem? What do you think? Does it exist? Somebody want to argue against it, the way it's being presented? Do you agree with them that it's bad? But it really shouldn't happen. We'd be better off if we saw ourselves as united and could accept our emotion and accept our sexes and feel comfortable with our bodies and see ourselves as united people, and I wouldn't use myself as a machine just to get my work done. Any problem?
That has a lot to do with lots that connected with grace, being able to accept oneself.
That's right. Yeah, moving, in terms of moving toward grace, we began to that, the first one is self-acceptance. And this is an absence of self-acceptance, right? I can accept only parts of myself, my rationality, or and not my whole body self. Okay? Let's move on to the second kind of dualism then. Sexist dualism, which he thinks is equally bad. Now, sexist dualism is when you don't have mutuality that love entails. You know, the coming together of two equal subjects, but one dominates the other. That's sexist dualism. One is dominating the other. Sexist dualism is, if spiritualistic dualism is the mind dominating the body, sexist dualism is one person dominating the other. Now in our society, he, and the way Nelson talks about it, is often the male dominating the female. Good old-fashioned sexism is what it means. But that's not all it means. It means any man, any person dominating another. A woman can also dominate a man. Now, he gets from mind dominating body to sexist dualism by the good old-fashioned projection theory. Are you all familiar with projection, the way psychologists talk about it? Let me just review it. You all be nice Freudian therapists, okay? And I'm your patient. And you tell me what you're going to ask me as I tell you my story, okay? It's a make-believe story, by the way. But this is You're all Freudian psychologists, right? And I come up to you and I say, do you know what? All through college, I didn't have a decent teacher. My dissertation advisor was an absolute fink. You know, he just was unfair, unjust, rotten to the core. Do you know at Denison University and at Concordia and at Merrimack College, the three places I taught, my chairman was sort of super fink. I mean, he's really, each one of them were rotten people. I've had bad luck there. And I hate policemen, too. You know, I really don't like policemen. You know, they're always so mean and grumpy and nasty. And the president of Denison University, you know, he's just a egotistical son of a gun. Now, as a Freudian psychologist, what are you going to be wondering about? I got a problem with authority, it seems like, right? Now, what might that stem from? Yeah, my parents, it might be what it is, and these are all male authorities. Which parent might it be? My father, that was how a Freudian would look at that. And, but he asked me about my father, right? How do you feel about your father? I love my father. Could that happen? Sure, what would happen is, according to the theory, I really am angry with my fathers, but I can't express that, right? Because in my society, I'm taught to love my daddy. So I repress all my anger about my father. And I got to project it someplace, don't I? Once I repress it, it's kind of like gets into a, you know, take only so much pressure. I think you think of a balloon, you know, and it's going to squirt out. And it projects then onto authority figures. Now, he would say the same thing happens in our families. Now, this isn't going to quite work as well as it works with my students because I always ask about parents. But think of somebody in your family. Is there somebody that drives you batty and you know you're going overreacting to what they're doing and you know you're overly sensitive because they do just what you do and you can't tolerate it? I hate it when my mother just starts getting perfectionism. You know, and she starts, and I get so impatient because I know I got the same trait. You know what I mean? Okay, once again, he was saying is we dislike that part of ourselves. We try to deny it in ourselves and project it and become very sensitive when it's on someone else. But what does this happen then? How do we get from spiritualistic dualism to sexist dualism? Well, start with the men. Our society says men cannot have to control their emotions, right? You have to be strong, tough, in control, always competent, always on top of things, you know. John Wayne's. So they repress all their emotion that they can't, project it onto women. And so when they come and meet a woman, they don't see the person, but their unresolved tension in themselves. Just as in the first example, when I'm dealing with my department chairman, I don't see my department chairman, you know, but my hostility to my daddy, and here's the hostility to the... And so, since they have to dominate their emotions in themselves, which takes a great deal of effort, controlling emotions is hard. Sometimes I've tried to do it, you know, or I was sort of raised in a culture where I had to... control emotions. And that takes a lot of energy, doesn't it? Controlling emotions. Well, then, I see these emotions I've controlled in this other person, so I try to dominate them. Or, how about women? You know, they're said, hey, if you're really good at this or that, you'll be unfeminine, right? So they project, repress it in themselves, they meet a man and expect him to be, excuse me, my body's getting its revenge. They expect him to be super competent, be able to do everything, super cool. Why? They're really hostile to him when he is. Repress, project. Have any of you ever read this kind of stuff about how the masses are stupid and how the masses are lazy and the masses are irresponsible? You know, that kind of stuff, the common people, you got to have that junk on television because they won't watch anything that's worthwhile. You've heard all that kind of aristocratic jargon. Same thing happens, doesn't it? Probably the aristocrats or the people that write it can't stand to deal with their own laziness or something projected onto the, quote, masses. No, according to Nelson, we have to dominate people because what we can't accept on in ourselves, we project on other people. And that leads to sexist dualism. We doubt our own worth, so we have to prove we're superior by winning. Let's use an example that might show what it is. Do you ever get a suspicion sometimes when somebody's bragging a great deal and always putting down other people as stupid, that that person's a little insecure about their own intelligence? Yeah, the same kind of thing. Or when somebody can't accept their own sexuality and repress it all the time, you know, boom, 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 then they get very self-righteous and judgmental on other people. They can dominate them, right? Okay, so he says the same thing happens. Sexist dualism, then, is a spiritualistic dualism, leads to sexist dualism in the sense of one person dominating the other person. In our culture, it happens to be generally men over women, but that's, it would apply anything. Now, one more thing I'd like to say about this is that these two dualisms relate not only to how we interact with other people, but how we interact with all of nature. In spiritualistic dualism, I don't value my body, right? I think it's inferior, something to be used or let go as inferior. Well, my body's made the same things that the rest of nature's made out of, right? So if I repress my body, aren't I inclined to think that nature can be used any way I want to or abused any way I want to? After all, you know, doesn't that mean I can strip mine to get anything I want or pollute the air as long as I don't hurt my mind? So Nelson sees a very definite relationship between how we treat our bodies and how we relate to other people and how we relate to nature. Okay, any question about either spiritualistic or sexist dualism? Now, those are the things that are bad. Estrangement, alienation, torn apart. Things he wants to get rid of. Any comments on that before we move on then to what he proposes? Yes?
Would you say also some of him must be the dominant factor in a professional relationship with guilty?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that the term can should go be applied elsewhere than just sex partners, because his whole sexuality would say would be involved in how I relate to my colleagues, right? And if I have to always dominate my colleagues, it's the same problem as sexist dualism. That would apply there too. Any kind of notion of I have to dominate. Okay, you with Nelson thus far? Any people want to raise complaints? Because if you buy this, you almost buy the rest of the system. Okay, so what do you want? Oh boy, she gave me some more water. That was nice of her. Thank you. I hope she gave it to me. I took it. Okay, salvation is a reuniting, a communion, a coming to wholeness. And the wholeness then would be the wholeness of our body selves and the wholeness communion with one another. What would be the characteristics of the salvation or the healing of the alienation and the brokenness? Well, the first characteristic would be self-acceptance, right? Being able to accept all my sexuality, being able to accept my emotions, being able to accept my feelings, not having things, being able to be comfortable with myself so I'm not uptight and trying to dominate others in other people what I don't like about myself. So self-acceptance becomes the first mark of reaching of what God wills for us in terms of salvation. The second one is sensuousness. Growth in sensuousness. Now that's, I think my mother would consider that a bad term, but not Nelson. Because sensuousness is an increased capacity to give and receive pleasure. It comes from the union of my body, emotional, and mental characteristics. It's self-abandonment, the willingness to take risks, letting go in the notion of real love. In love, you know, what do? You let go, right? You take a risk. It's a spontaneous enjoyment of one's body and one's partner's body. It's a playfulness. When you feel comfortable with your body and you don't feel uptight, there's often a lot of playfulness, right? I mean, playfulness is great fun, isn't it? Any of you here for 4th of July? There's a lot of silly playfulness. There's a lot of silly playfulness at Holden, right? All the time. There's a certain kind of sense of comfort with one another, right? When you have this playfulness, you feel a certain kind of unity of body and in mind. You don't, you know, you're just sort of acting spontaneously and doing something, even if it's silly. Well, for him, that's a very good thing. Another is freedom. Freedom to feel, freedom to care. Abandonment, so you can feel emotions. Merriment, being happy. Feeling elation. Feeling gaiety. A feeling to care. And this gives you some real highs, because you can really care and feel joys. You know, do you ever get the sense that when you're embarrassed or uptight about yourself, you can't even enjoy something? You're too self-conscious, you're not comfortable. This is going to give you some highs. What else is it going to increase besides joy?
Opposite.
Pain. Because this would be the freedom to care for other people. Freedom to empathize, to feel what other people are feeling. I think of the time when I was in college. I was in graduate school at the time. And I was seeing pictures of Vietnamese children that had been napalmed. Have any of you seen those pictures? You know, where the faces are melted down to the chests, you know, sort of like wax figures. And I was watching them, and all of a sudden I started superimposing pictures of kids I knew. You know what that did to me? You know, so I saw my niece up there, my nephew up there, my cousins. I had to stop. I had to stop. You know, I look down and stop, or I would have been running, screaming out of that room. Well, that's what the, excuse me, this cold is not good. Well, that's what the freedom would be. Freedom to really feel, which means freedom to share sufferings with other people and to care. Feelings to allow ourselves to look at the world as other people look at it. Feelings to find out, read some of the writings about what it would be like to be a third world person. And even freedom to sort of empathize with these people. Allowing our emotions not to be checked off. Do you ever notice how we try to check off our emotions a lot? I live alone, so I always watch Eat Supper to Walter Cronkite. Now I have to get used to Dan, rather. It's like a divorce. But Walter and I would have dinner every day together. You know, so, and he'd say goodnight, and I'd say goodnight, Walter. And there I would be eating, you know, and they'd be showing the latest catastrophe on television. And I'd be shoveling the food down, you know, so many people killed, and see terrorists shooting it out. We isolate ourselves from our feelings. What Nelson is saying, that as we grow in self-acceptance so we can accept all of ourselves, sensuousness, experience freedom and joy, then we'll be able to respond sensitively to the feelings of others. And I want to read an example of what he talks about, freedom to respond sensitively to others. And I'll read it because it kind of struck my attention. It might be something people would want to discuss. And he's describing what he sees as a very fine relationship, which is the correct use of sexuality. And he's describing then how we're often afraid of sexuality and how it can help in healing. And I'll read the account that he gives. And he's describing the experiences of a close friend and a clergy colleague. So the man was a close friend and a clergy person. a clergyman. His mother was dying of cancer, and I'm just reading it to you. Her body was clearly showing the ravages of the disease, and she was distressed by her altered appearance. On the one hand, she was resistant to the visits of those close to her because of her disfigurement. Yet at the same time, her need for physical closeness and personal intimacy was great. Her son came to the hospital to visit, and as they talked, he rubbed her back to relieve some of the pain. After a time, sensing her need for even greater closeness, he lay down on the hospital bed beside her and held her closely in his arms. In that position, they talked for a long time that afternoon, sharing thoughts and feelings more deeply than ever before. Later that night, she died. It was, said my friend, clearly a sexual experience of the most appropriate kind between mother and son, an experience of physical closeness which deepened love's bonds and eased the pain of the impending death. You see the kind of freedom Nelson's talking about? Okay, finally, another mark of this healing is androgyny. Now, androgyny means having male and female characteristics together in one person. It doesn't mean anything like bisexuality, you know, where you'd have sex relationships with both men and women, or hermaphrodite, being a hermaphrodite. But what it means is, according to Nelson, we're all the same, basically. We all have emotions and intelligence and reason. And we ought to be able to express those when they're appropriate. And he thinks that we get into a real bad bind in our society because the men are forced to act according to one stereotype and the women act according to another. So men can't cry and women can't be competent in math or can't know how to fix a car or whatever. Now what he talks about in terms of androgyny is saying we ought to have the freedom to, when it's appropriate to be strong, be strong whether we're men and women. And when it's appropriate to express and feel emotion and tenderness, we ought to be able to feel that whether we're male, a man or woman, and not have this divided up. Guess who he uses as a model of an androgynous person who show that characteristics to be, you know, strong and very emotional? Jesus, right. Think of Jesus' relationships. You know, it's kind of funny in some of the art, you know, how the femininity of Jesus will sometimes be expressed. I suppose everybody's seen Solomon's Head of Christ, haven't you? Haven't you that one that's in all the little churches? If you cover the beard, you know, you get a woman with a woman's face on the top part. But Jesus was really not bound by sex stereotyping, was he? So that's the model for androgyny. So he's calling us into androgyny. And of course, all of this then would be love and communion. Communion then coming together of people that are two distinct individuals in mutuality, love, and caring. Now, next page is his standards for sexual activity, his guiding principles. So does anybody have anything they'd like to say in terms of his concept of salvation and alienation, his interpretation of Jesus as androgynous? He's saying we should all follow Jesus in this sense of being able to use the appropriate emotions and not have to repress half of ourselves. And the freedom to care and love. Any comments? People would like to make on this? Yes.
Yeah, one just thing to affirm what you're saying. When Paul talks about in Romans 12, I think it is, about the different functions of ministry. He talks about insight and leadership and giving and teaching. And one of them is one of these seven gifts is mercy. And one interesting model that I've seen of the church is that where the church is alive, all these functions will be present, and certain people are stronger in one than in the other. And so we need to encourage one another's gifts and to put them into use under the Lordship of Christ in our mutual ministry. Now, this person was saying that sometimes children have a mercy gift, and it might be a boy. And in their teaching this, the families that have heard this teaching and have absorbed it have been tremendously freed up, because the general stereotype of the boy who has a mercy gift, has that trait in him, is that the father thinks of him as a sissy, and he says, you can't be that way. And now when people hear that, some people tend to be more of that way, in this life, it really frees them up and encourages them to let the person be, develop those traits, and that they're appropriate ways of expressing. It doesn't mean he's going to be homosexual, it doesn't mean he's going to be a sissy. And I think that is it's coming from a completely different angle, but it is affirming what you're saying about that last point, that this kind of wholeness frees us up for, it's a big word, what is it, androgyny?
Androgyny, yeah. Androgyny, yeah. Yeah, not having, it just means that just what you're saying. But
parents, I think, will tend to stereotype their own children, yeah, and want to suppress certain traits. Or the other way is the top girl.
I was going to speak to that. That's very difficult for parents when you have a girl who hears a different drummer. I have a girl who drives a 18-wheeler. And very, very difficult for some of my friends. And then when she married and had a baby and breastfed that baby and took that baby with she and her husband, you know, it's a different drummer. You know, it's hard for me to do, but I never saw such a secure baby in my life. But it's really difficult. It's really difficult when you have a child who hears a different drummer than, you know, the stereotype that you don't expect.
Yeah, well, I think my mother would have wished I was married too. Yes.
Even Everton, someone told me some children had what was classified as behavior or emotional problems, and a lot of the best way I heard them describe was that they didn't have the same socialized emotional controls. And sometimes I had to respect their ability to just scream and yell at me 15 minutes straight at the top of their lungs, but then 15 minutes later they were almost healed in the sense that they could come back and sit down next to me and not be angry. I wished I had that capacity to these were little boys, to just scream and cry back at them and then be done. Rather than holding it and stuffing it inside and knowing if I lost it or not.
It's hard not to get conformed into these kinds of stereotypes. It's hard to accept kids that don't do it either. I'd like to meet your daughter. I've never I think I'd enjoy her.
She's a gem.
I think nowadays, I don't know what the rest of you think, but I think nowadays, as far as this kind of androgyny, women have more freedom than men. I mean, there's still some women that, or some people that might consider me, I think not too long ago, men had more freedom in the sense they could be a bachelor or something and I'd be an old maid or spinster. And now, you know, people are getting to see maybe I could be a career woman and choose that freely. But I think men have a harder time. I mean, I could, when I was raised, my mother let me be a tomgirl until, I don't know, I think I snapped out of it myself, but... she and I still fight about when she made me quit playing tackle football. I think it was in the fourth grade. She says it was in the sixth grade, but it's irrelevant. Nancy Shaw got to play tackle football till the eighth grade with the boys. But, you know, I had more freedom in that, and my brother then didn't have much freedom in terms of playing with dolls or anything.
I think there's a tendency to think females will grow out of it.
Yeah. Well, my brother's son now has dolls, something my brother wasn't allowed. So he has dolls, which is helpful. But you get to adults. I mean, I can choose my role, and people will look at me. Some of them think I'm a little funny. Other people think I'm fine, you know, and that's okay. But take a man that chooses an alternative route for a man, and as some of my friends have done, decides that he will be the primary housekeeper and primary parenter. They've often found this incredibly difficult, say much more difficult than a woman choosing to be a career woman. other women in the neighborhood. I mean, he can't quite, our society isn't set up so he can stop and have coffee with the other people taking care of the home at 10 o'clock in the morning. And men will often just sort of walk away from him as if he is, you know, an embarrassment to them. You know, so in some ways I think men, and now in our changing of culture roles, men have it better in terms of making money and getting better jobs still, the salary. Women make 59% what men make working full-time, 12 months a year employment. That was in 1978, I think, or 77. I don't know if it's how much it's increased since then. But men, I think, have women have a greater flexibility now. In many ways. One way is in terms of choosing alternative ways of living. The other way is in terms of expressing affection for women. I mean, at Denison, nobody would think anything as if I would hug a woman that I hadn't seen in a while. You know, but at Denison, you know, they would, men would only be able to show affection for other men by this slapping on the back and this calling him a nasty name and roasting him or tossing him in a lake. You know, every time they really like a guy, they throw him in that pond. So, you know, so women in terms of have, in some ways, greater flexibility, I think, than men.
Especially if she's married and has children. But if you're single, I think over 30 and have never been married and you hug another woman, what the? Now then they really start to, I really think that makes a difference.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah, there's a certain sense of, there's so much homophobia around that you could get labeled a gay person. But
I think she's right about the age. You know, I teach at college, and we have a girls' basketball team that was a winning team, and the guys come out to watch them play, and vice versa, and so on, and these girls hug each other, and, you know, there's a kind of, what, you know, it's beautiful how you put it, this playfulness with self-acceptance in that area. No problems, but I'm thinking that they're 20, you know, 18, 19, 20, 21, and when you're still single, by whatever, you know, decree, divine or personal, at a little older age, I imagine that is a problem. But I wonder, the question I have is, do you have any comments to make whether this is an American phenomenon, or if this is kind of European too, or is there a different freedom in Europe in this regard?
In what?
Well, you're talking about hugging men.
Oh, yeah, Europeans seem to, you lived in Europe, you're better than I am, but it seems to me that Americans are probably the worst culture. I think perhaps Africans have the greatest freedom in terms of expressing affection for other men. I think, as far as I can tell, people in Europe have greater freedom than American men, and American men are about the worst off in terms of expressing affection for other men. Why do you think there is such a taboo, you know, against that in America?
I think it is really closely connected with the control and the stereotype that you have to be controlled.
Have to have control, but you can express affection toward women.
Yeah, well.
But even so, only certain women. There's, you know, your mother, your wife, your girlfriend, you know, if you're, I can even see it in some of my friends who are newly married, you know, whereas maybe it would have been acceptable to hug and kiss them, now they're married, so there's a little more of a...
Why?
Just socially, you know, yeah. My problem.
Yeah, yeah, why do you feel that way? I can't recall that but I'd less have to hug someone because they're married or not married. You know, I'm not.
I think I'm respecting the lady.
Respect of the lady. Okay, if it's a man.
I don't want to make that
okay. Oh, yeah.
That's what I'm saying. A male. Female.
Oh, okay. A male, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's my best friends in terms of having families where I can come and stay. It's always, not always, but it's often a family where I've known the woman first and got to know her husband, because then she knows I'm not after him.
Right. Yeah. But my experience is that, like, with someone there from the school, it's easier to be more affectionate with the man there. If I'm free, because I know where his commitment is, and I don't have to worry if he
instinctively when I hug him and stuff, there's kind of a freedom. Both my male friends and other women friends at seminary, we talk about that. It's easier to be friends, for Jonathan, it's easier to be friends with Mary who marries Brian, because he knows he can be friends with her and she'll not think about marrying him or make an commitment with him, because he has that kind of freedom. So I think part of it, our inability to be self-accepting and free with our sexuality is a concern for miscommunication about what a hug means, or some, I think it's a fear about our ability to be irresponsible about our sexuality or how we with it. And I think sometimes we wonder, or we fear that we're not going to be in control so that we don't go beyond the limits.
Yeah, that's, and I wonder if that's a man's experience as much as a woman's, because often we've had to keep the control.
Right, you've been the one saying,
you know, I mean, the guy always made the pass, and I was the one that had to say no.
Sometimes
yes. What?
Sometimes even maybe they were hoping you would.
Well, I mean, everybody knew what was going to happen. I mean, it was so ritualized. The script was written out. Yes.
Because American men have been American men for such a relatively short amount of time as opposed to the Europeans. And American men in our country had to be the gay men. They had to be the conqueror and the provider and the rebellion. And in Europe, the whole population was not involved in constant warfare. They perhaps were oppressed, but they weren't all the knighthood class. And they'd been there for so long without proving anything.
Yeah, I think in general, though, Americans, I could be wrong, but I think of Krister Stendel's comment, you know, that we tend to be more, I think, uptight about sex than Europeans in general. Krister Stendel was talking one time when he saw, Krister Stendel is a Swedish-born, Swedish-educated, used to be dean of Harvard Divinity School, Lutheran clergyman, professor. And he talked about one time, just expressed sadness, as only Krister can do with his Swedish piety, at seeing a bunch of real little kids going swimming in bathing suits. And he said, look, they're teaching them to be embarrassed about their bodies already. You know, in Sweden, they wouldn't have had bathing suits. Yes?
I think another thing that forces this mold is our TV and movies. The John Waynes, you know, all of that high noon sort of model.
Yeah, John, the high noon is Gary Cooper, but he is the perfect sexist dualist, isn't he?
Yeah.
And spiritualistic dualist?
Yeah.
And the Marlboro
Man.
And the Marlboro Man, right.
Well, because they had to go out and win the frontier, and Europeans don't relate to that.
Yeah. Well, you think the winning the frontier?
Because men were men.
I don't know, but women got out and they had to shoot the bear if their husband was gone, and you know.
But they weren't essentially the warrior of the family.
They were awfully strong, though.
I hear women
were strong, yeah.
You know, were more equal than a lot of instances before.
Yeah, I think probably my grandmother, in terms of being homesteaders. You know, I mean, my grandfather may have helped her in and out of a carriage when they went to town, but I'm sure there was a lot of sharing and kind of situation going on there. That's all interesting. I think a lot of this is just plain fear and risk of being labeled. I think one of the reasons in America men won't have trouble expressing affection to other men is they're afraid they're going to be labeled gay. You know, the same thing that the person said in terms of even a woman who is my age and who's never been married can be called gay. The fate of the label. Which really shows how hard gay people have it, right? In terms of the label, if even straight people are afraid of the label. Or people might want to not express affection toward another person because they're going to be afraid that they're going to misunderstand. And then they'll be labeled either an aggressor or something. Or take this account I read that Nelson talked about with the clergyman who laid down with his mother and comforted her. That's a very beautiful account, I think. He Yet I think it would be very frightening for someone if somebody would walk in. They would not understand.
I was waiting for you to say the nurse walked in and told them you had to get up.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the sense of, yeah. Well, let's look, you know, we got just a few more, I got 20 more minutes, but let's look at what he suggests, and then we get back to this if we'd like to, in terms of standards or ethical norms. Now, these aren't going to be these nice little norms we had here, you know, that told us things were good and bad, right or wrong. But here are his principles in terms of sexual activity. First of all, he says he can't do this. Because we can't do any of this. Yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. Can't evaluate acts without considering the motives, intentions, and consequences. And I had written no hard, fast rules, and I changed it to few hard, fast rules. Let you figure. Good motives, intentions, and consequences are those which promote body wholeness and communion between people. Good sexual activities or ways of relating sexually are those that help us overcome spiritualistic and sexist dualisms. That's living out of or living in God's wholeness, creating love. So he can't have any nice little right and wrongs. We have to look at the meaning, the motives, the consequences of the act. And that might mean an act might mean something for me and something different for her, be right for me and wrong for her. Now, can anybody figure out why I changed the no to a few? Are there any acts that we could say would always be wrong because they promote one of those two dualisms?
Rape.
Yeah, I think rape would be one of them where the meaning of the very act, the person that may rape may be trying to get some kind of feeling. I don't know. But the meaning of the act would be domination, right? That's what rape is. Rape is dominating another person, humiliating the other person, imposing your will on another person.
Incest. No.
What?
Incest.
Incest, yeah. He doesn't discuss incest, but that might well belong in there too, particularly when it's, you know, young people, right? I'm not sure it would be in terms of, wouldn't it be brothers and sisters who are 50 years old, wouldn't that be incest too? I'm not sure that would always, you know, so clearly fall into it, but certainly the kind of incest that we normally think of as child molestation. Anybody think of anything else? Well, promiscuity, okay, he's got a real problem with promiscuity, doesn't he? Because that's one of them, that's a clear, the problem with promiscuity is that means it's really spiritualistic dualism because you're not combining your emotional commitments with sexuality. You're letting the body do its thing. Divorced from the mind. He has another one, sadomasochism. Now he thinks sadomasochism are people trying to have communion, but the meaning of it, according to Nelson, is always domination, right? In sadomasochism, somebody hurts another person. Now everything else is wide open. You know, but those are the things. He says the meaning of it is that people think they can only reach communion by dominating someone else. And he sees no way of going through possible meanings to come up with some reason why that might be acceptable in situations. So he's pretty, in fact, when he talks about sexual variations, that's the only, he doesn't really discuss rape or incest, that's the only one that he explicitly, he also would have trouble with promiscuity, because that just seems to be promoting spiritualistic dualism. Okay, we can go through some others if you'd like, but let's...
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
How would you define promiscuity? Maybe it's not as hard and fast a definition.
Oh, depersonalized sex was how I did it, libertine, where you try to have interchangeability of sex partners. It doesn't matter who the person is. There's no love commitment involved.
So it involves depersonalization rather than numbers.
Well, if you have a lot of numbers of partners, you would think there's really not a caring relationship. Notice number two. The physical expression of one's sexuality with another person ought to be appropriate to the level of loving commitment present in that relationship.
But well, would it be possible, I mean, just for the sake of the discussion, just if you'll have more than one close friendship, then you might be able to have more than one appropriate
Okay, I think.
Not that being under the decorum.
I think there's a difference in. Yeah, I think there's a difference in talking about one or two relationships, or, you know, over a lifetime, who knows how many. And what he means by libertine kind of thing is, what he has in mind is what one Denison student did. He had a scorecard on his door. It would go by fives, 5, 10, 15, 20, 25. And those were all of his scoring that he had done in terms of having affairs. So certainly he definitely is not saying we ought to always have monogamy, and monogamy is the only way. He's not saying that, you know, but he is saying that a promiscuity or libertine approach is where you're just sort of letting the body do what it wants, and there's no commitment or care involved. And I think a good example of that is when you can interchange partners, when it doesn't matter who the person is. And it's depersonalized, because in a sense you can be talking about that person then as a vibrator, you know, something that gives me sexual pleasure. And he does have problems with that one, because it violates this one.
When he uses the word consequences, does that imply unwanted pregnancy?
Yeah, he would be concerned that people ought to accept responsibility for their use birth control and stuff like that. Or consequences in the sense of, say, if you were trying to deal with a relationship that might involve adultery and might have dire consequences for children or for the other spouse involved, you know, all those kinds of things would be taken into account, yes. Okay, and finally then, love entails a single standard, not a double standard for sexual morality. One standard that would apply to all people, no double standard.
By all people, do you mean, or does he mean men and women?
Men and women.
Or married and single?
Married and single, a 21-year-old and an 81-year-old, a heterosexual and a homosexual. Yes.
Okay, where my anxiety comes in is where does the church come in as far as, say, premarital sex goes? I mean, I've seen a lot of changes in the Lutheran church. Just being here, it's just so open and liberal and all this. And I just want to know, does the Lutheran church now condone premarital sex if there is love?
Which is in church. The LCA has a statement, which is not the ALC, that is allows for that possibility that it may be love, marriage, and family, that there may be premarital sex. I don't know what the ALC statement is. Does anybody know what the ALC has done on this? The LCA has a social statement. Now see what, now here's where Nelson would probably, the way you're asking that question, you know, he would maybe look at the differences. He would say, you know, it doesn't really matter what the official church says. What you ought to be looking at in terms of deciding whether a premarital relationship would be appropriate and helpful would be, you know, how much physical and emotional intimacy is there in the relationship? How much commitment? Is this physical expression a natural form of commitment? Is one person dominating the other person? If so, that gives you an idea that this relationship is not very healthy. You know, it's really not the relationship you wanted. Is there complete honesty? So there's no deception being involved. So that no one is deceiving another person. You know, communion is the coming together of equals, love. So the kind of feed you a line and lie and manipulation, you know, I love you, I love you, I love you, I want to marry you, is just, you know, there's no place for it in terms of this kind of thing. What are the motives? Sometimes we can have sexual intercourse to get even with mommy, to degrade the person we're having intercourse with, you know, dominate them. What are the intentions? You know, what would be the consequences of this relationship? So all these things would be taken into account, and he will not completely rule out premarital sex. So, you know, he'll leave it, you know, if it conforms to these criteria.
I have another question about definition. I always have trouble with what people mean by the words that they use. What would be a definition, a number two, and commitment? Does that mean a monogamous commitment? Does that mean a lifetime commitment? Or does that just mean a commitment to the person's integrity?
Commitment to love, concern about the caring for, loving, fostering the growth of the other person, not necessarily lifelong. He comes down favoring monogamy in marriage. Really radical. But, you know, he can see some exceptions to it. And he is cautious about premarital sex in the sense that it's often exploitative. Mm-hmm. And it's often, you know, some people, at least Dennis, use sex as sort of a shortcut to a relationship, and it never works. You know, forming a relationship with another person is very hard and time-consuming. Boy, it takes a lot of effort. You know, really hard, really long. That's why moving is so hard, because, you know, you got to build up all those relationships again. And some people try to make a shortcut, you know, to that with sex, and it doesn't work. So he'd be against that. You know, that's just going to lead to exploitation, any kind of deception. But he certainly leaves open the possibility in premarital sex. And if people care about one one another, do not deceive one another, want to help one another grow, but that would be a possibility. Yes?
You know, what I'm concerned about in that is the self-deception that we get into. Prophets are always very uneasy about the human heart. And, you know, I may think I'm doing this out of love and all these good things you're saying, but maybe there are a lot of things I haven't, like, as you said, maybe I'm getting even with something in my family relationship, and I'm not aware of things. In a sense, he's setting a higher standard almost than, let's say, the Ten Commandments, to make it simple. Because that's just a not. Thou shalt not commit adultery. It doesn't say all these things. Would you say that his ethics, in a sense, are more demanding than the Christian way?
Then what?
Sounds that way.
Then which ones?
Than the traditional Christian.
Yeah, I started out with the traditional ones being a natural law, classical natural law, and that's very undemanding compared to this. Because that would just sort of take some actions, and you could either yes or no, and it would be okay. And what he's asking for then is something that is really, as you say, well.
It's a high, really very idealistic definition.
Well, it's, yeah. Now, I think his answer to what you're doing, so he started out with this, and he would be, you know, this is what he's arguing against. You know, certain things are right and wrong. What he's doing is, it's idealistic, but I think he's also concerned with the kind of hypocrisy that develops with people using the traditional morality. Mm-hmm. Namely, saying repressing my emotions, not caring about other people, not allowing myself to feel, being overly concerned, and calling that virtue because I'm not having sexual contact or sexual relationships with someone. You know, and so he's also very much concerned about that. And he's also concerned that our theology has been promoting spiritualistic dualism. And theologians, you know, theologians, they're very big on that. Every theology I learned, with the possible exception of Tillich and the way it was taught, I learned it that way, was all head. You know, all mind. You know, no place in the sense of, you know, you do theology and it's sort of like, very intellectual. What he's trying to do is incorporate feelings and emotions, all of us, into that, and attacking the standard way that theology is done. And he would say that you can get from how we understand ourselves as sexual people to how we understand God. And he will use passages like from Hosea that says that when God, in Hosea, God compares, the prophet Hosea speaks of God's love for Israel as God's love for an unfaithful wife, Hosea's love for Gomer, who is unfaithful. And that God confronts us in our sexuality. And then that will solve our problems with grace, because we see that we desire and love at the same time. And, you know, so he's really serious about rethinking all theology, giving our bodies some kind of notion.
The first statement you have there on evaluating motives, something like, and commit, consequences. Does the, you know, when you start with an evaluation, you know, how do you, what's your criteria for evaluating? What do you
okay, the motives should be to promote communion and love and overcome the dualisms. Maybe we can get through this a little better by using a concept, something controversial.
Can I give an example?
Yeah.
If I can be open here with the group. I had a hard time after being married for 6 years and sexual experiences in my marriage having been very negative, very husband dominated, very exploited, having left me feeling very, very bad about myself. None of the things that I believe sex was intended to be. And since being single, having had a couple of very positive sexual relationships, and that did fit into his guidelines. I wasn't familiar with his book or these thoughts. That's why this is interesting to me here. And then having a struggle with that because my experience was totally contrary to my Christian upbringing. Now, which was right and which was wrong was what I was dealing with. Was it right when it was exploitive and tearing me down as a person, tearing each other down in the marriage, and wrong when it was positive and building each other up as human beings outside of marriage? It didn't make sense to me, and I couldn't accept it.
That's one of the reasons Nelson wrote the book, because he felt that it was promoting these kinds of values, which really, you know, are nice, but, you know, really, really can hurt people. Yes?
I dreaded the day when any of my children were going to live with someone else outside of marriage, but now, after having experienced much the same as she has said, I would much rather have either of my daughters or my son living with someone in a wonderful relationship or a good one than married to someone in a rotten one. And I don't think any church doctrine can cast a frowning glance at that. What is important, the relationship or the little piece of paper?
Well, there are also consequences, you know, that people would have to take responsibility for, you know, babies and stuff like that. I think though, what you know, we have, this is, it's real, I think, for many of us, desire to accept this, but I think what Hans is talking about is that the possibility of self-deception is really there.
Oh, one part of
the
commitment and the other one doesn't.
That's right. Yeah. And the kind of using, the manipulation.
That's what I am concerned. How are the boy and the girl going to evaluate each other's motives, mm-hmm. each other's...
You're going to travel on faith just like you go to heaven, kind of, really, if you stop and think about it. Because
but each guideline is evaluate.
Yes, but you evaluate for yourself.
Yeah.
And that's the only person that you can know for. And the other person, unless they give you very bad otherwise examples, you're going to take on faith.
Yeah, this is where the risk that people are talking about is very good, or very true, because this is a lot, very risky. And it involves evaluating my own emotions, which I can't always do very well. You know, I'm capable of deceiving myself. Notice how this system was a lot safer. Now, where is it? Yeah, it just told me exactly what to do and what not to do. I mean, that was nice, right? Nice little moral handbook. I knew just what to do and what not to do. This makes it a lot harder and a lot riskier. Yes.
That's also kind of there's room for growth early in that, though, too. Whereas, I'm being judgmental to the other system, but I think he has to enter in there somewhere.
What?
A certain level of maturity. Maybe that goes in with evaluating motives, intentions, and consequences.
Yeah, this is a system, the ethics for mature people and for people that are honest with themselves and all sorts of things. You know, it's for the immature people, like for little children, we give them rules. Do this and do that. But this is for maturity. Yes? Yes?
Do you think there are any disadvantages in the trend for
unisexual. I mean, you know, you have unisex hair salons, and you have people wearing the same kind of clothes, and everything is just like a factory. Do you see any disadvantages in making people all alike?
No.
I mean, I can't see any. I just want to make
No, I don't. I mean, every once in a while somebody says something about if we do have this androgyny thing, but we're all free to express what is appropriate for us and not have to go to men and women stereotypes. I remember my pastor, who thinks he's so liberated on this subject, said, well, you don't want to go too far or everybody will become neuter. And I didn't say much because, you know, I mean, he's a nice guy and I, you know, and I'm an authority acceptor. would never contradict a pastor in public, you know that. But, I mean, what's neuter? I've been around a whole bunch of group of women. And we're not neuters. You know, we're very distinctive people. I've been around, often been the only woman in a group because of my profession. And those men aren't neuters. You know, they're all distinctive people. So I don't really see any danger of some neutering, if that's what you're talking about, because we're all distinctive people. You know, it doesn't matter whether, you know, we are. And so that seems to me, I can't see any issue. Maybe somebody else can see some issues that they'd like to raise. Yes?
I think it's kind of interesting that women have adopted men's clothing, but you don't see men in dresses in public. And I don't know if that says something or not.
Except the Scotch kilts.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of, yeah. Unless you're Scottish. Or clergymen.
The only thing is wearing that.
Pastors all dress up like women.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mentioned that in the group, and my pastor quickly told me, started doing the history of the chasuble, which I made. Christer Stenzel said that being a pastor was an interesting profession by our sex stereotyping, because it's the one role where the man is supposed to have feminine qualities. I guess that's why we didn't ordain women for so long, huh? You know, be very feminine in terms of caring, nurturing, gentle, and then Christer said, and we even wore skirts on Sunday. I think that really comes down to the fact that we were saying earlier that women today have greater freedom than men in terms of violating role. And I think part of it is we're more afraid of homosexuality in men than in women.
Okay.